to read a part of a sermon that was preached in chapel by Roy Harrisville. Might have been before you got there, Nancy. Anyway, the title of it is If I Were God, and it's on the text of For God So Loved the World. For God so loved the world, if I were God, it would have been a horse of a different color. If I were God, I would have pitched Gabriel, Michael, and all the rest of the heavenly hierarchy on their celestial noses in a wild haste to get even. To hell with special seats for the bomb makers and the pitiless, self-righteous, and aimless, spineless, conformist middle class. That's where the world would have gone if I were God. I would have made another world, and if by some cruel Zoroastrian trick it turned out to be as the first, I would destroy it and build still another. And I'd sit on my pale blue cloud and rub my omnipotent hands at the burning. But if moved by some kind of affection, if stirred by some love for what I had made, I should give the world anything. I would give it what I could do without. To one man, a pretty girl, to another, a castle by the sea, to another, power, to still another, a home, mortgage-free. I would pour out of my gigantic cornucopia, bright sunny afternoons, wheat at $10 a bushel, hogs so fat they couldn't stand, and consumers enough to balance out the economy, an end to cancer and sinus trouble, good books, one great, rosy, peaceful world, and forgetfulness above all. I would give the world what I didn't need. I would give it what it thought it needed. And while my worshippers hung from the chandeliers and stamped my name on their cigar bands and toothpaste tubes, I'd yell noblesse oblige, because it would all be a mere bagatelle. But God loved the world, and whatever else the difference between us may be, this is the difference to end all differences. And because he loved, he gave himself. That's the meaning of the words, he gave his only begotten son. It wasn't at all, as some of our theologians have described it, God standing about biting his cuticles in a blue funk over the current situation, calling for volunteers, and after embarrassed silence from the angels, enter one Jesus, followed by tearful debate and one last embrace. Jesus was sent forth, but Jesus was sent forth from the very heart of God. God was there at Bethlehem, not in the bleachers, but in the crib where Joseph could tickle him in the navel and smelling shepherds breathe their germs on him. Imagine God getting his ears washed, coming home from school in torn pantaloons, reciting the old verse of Bar Mitzvah. Today I am a man with dirty feet and in need of a bath. He was there at Golgotha, naked as a peeled grape, face dripping spit and blood, stone cold dead, and prey to worms. I would never have done it if I were God. And he goes on, but God loved in a way to set the heart afire. For whatever else it was that brought him here, it was love. And for me, love high, wide, deep, and constant, like a river that never runs dry, where a man can slake his thirst, come drought or come plenty. Well, this Harrisville is one of the real stylists in preaching. I don't suppose the chapel was ever empty when he spoke. Well, let's go to Luke 15. He talked about the woman with silver coins, and she'd lost one, and the shepherd who'd lost a sheep. And then he goes on to say, Jesus went on to say, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to him, Father, give me now my share of the property. So the man divided the property between his two sons, and after a few days, the younger son sold his part of the property and left home with the money. He went to a country far away where he wasted his money in reckless living. He spent everything he had. Then a severe famine spread over the country and he was left without a thing. So he went to work for one of the citizens of that country who sent him out to the farm to take care of pigs. He wished he could fill himself with the bean pods the pigs ate, but no one gave him anything to eat. At last he came to his senses and said, all my father's hired workers have more than they can eat, and here I am about to starve. I will get up and go to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against God and against you. I'm no longer fit to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired workers. So he got up and started back to his father. He was still a long way from home when his father saw him. His heart was filled with pity, and he ran, threw his arms around his son, and kissed him. Father, the son said, I have sinned against God and against you, and I am no longer fit to be called your son. But the father called his servants. Hurry, he said, bring the best robe and put it on him, put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet, and then go and get the prize calf and kill it, and let's celebrate with a feast. Because the son of mine was dead, and now is alive. He was lost, but now he's found. And so the feasting began. I want to read at this point the sequel or about the second son. Well, I said I wanted to talk a little about what excited me most about this parable. It's in many ways, I think, my favorite. The first look at the father who let his son go. One might ask, how in the world, knowing his son's disposition, and he was fairly sure, I'm sure, that what the son would do with that money, being disposed as he was, why in the world did he let him go? Why didn't he, you know, tell him, no, you're not going to get that money, at least until you get to your senses, and in the meantime, I'm not even going to give you money enough to get out of town. You're going to stay put until you get some wisdom. Well, that's probably what I would have done, and maybe in retrospect my son would have thanked me. But actually what I would be doing then would be to curtail, limit my son's freedom of choice. And the remarkable thing about God, kind of the terrifying thing, is that he doesn't do that. If I understand right, the creation story, when God created man and gave to him and made him in his image and likeness, the distinguishing thing that God gave to man that he didn't give to any other creature was the gift of choice, the freedom, the right of self-determination. And at no time in dealing with us does God ever take that away. We have to understand that about him. That what he wants is not an army camp. He doesn't want a zoo where he, puts us in cages and limits our freedom. He wants a family. And he wants his children to have the same quality that he has, and the unique quality that he's given his children is the gift of choice, the gift of freedom. And so the remarkable thing, it seems to me, about the father initially, when he lets him go, gives him the property and lets him go, is to enforce this fact about God and about you and me, that until the end, we are given unlimited freedom of choice. It's a terrifying thing that I can stand God at bay. You know, I can ward him off. With all his love and with all his power, I can ward him off. I can go my own way and go straight to hell, and he won't stop me. He won't stop me in the sense of limiting my freedom and saying, I won't let you do this. In other words, he doesn't set up rules or kind of fences. He gives us the right to break them and to do what we want. I think this was the picture that I got in the Brothers Karamazov in Dostoevsky's book. And that little interlude would call The Grand Inquisitor. When I read that, I just tingled. And I was enchanted or absorbed and almost scared. The story, as some of you may remember, if you've read it, is the Inquisition in Seville, France, or Seville, Spain, I suppose about in the 13th century, when it was not uncommon for them to identify the heretics and kill them, behead them usually. And the Grand Inquisitor was the guy who determined who was a heretic or not and who should have his head cut off. He was a cardinal of 90 years of age. And one day, as heads were being cut off, and the people were there about to die, some of them and their friends and family around them grieving, suddenly Jesus appeared and began to comfort those, and then everybody knew it was Jesus, and the guards went to the cardinal to tell him that Jesus had appeared, and the cardinal ordered them to put Jesus in a cell. And then at night he came to Jesus and said, tomorrow you're going to die as the greatest of all heretics. And he said, you made the great mistake of asking only the free response of the love of your children. And we've had to correct that. We've had to give them rules and let them be hedged in by rules, and if they break the rules, we forgive them, and then they are happy, and then they go back to observing and breaking the rules and all of that. And he said, three times you had a chance to control people and not just to love them. Said, the wise one came to you in the wilderness, and he said, he told you could control people by providing them with food. Turn this these stones into bread and give the bread to people, and you can have control over people. And when you turned him down on that, he suggested that you control them by magic or by simply overcoming them with awe and mystery. Throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple and let the angels pick you up, and you will control them. When he turned you down on that, then he offered you to control people by force. All the kingdoms of the world I'll give you if you bow down and worship me. And you turned him down the third time. Now we've decided to correct your work. So we will control people by the dole, by giving them what they need. We'll control them by mystery and magic and wonder works, and we'll control them by sheer force, by power. And the people will be happier that way, because they can't stand freedom. Freedom is too heady a gift for them. Only a few great saints can respond to you in free love. All the rest will want rules and regulations and all of that, and if we give them that, they'll be happy. In the final analysis, they'll all be marching to the same drum, and that's the way they like it. And so we've had to correct your work, and tomorrow you're going to die as the great heretic. Well, when he told this to Jesus, finally, he said, of course, we know better, we who, you know, I know better. I know what you set out to get, but we've set out to correct your work. And it was kind of a picture of the Roman Catholic Church, I suppose, at the time. Anyway, finally, when he got finished talking, there was silence, and Jesus hadn't said anything. Jesus had sat there looking at him. And finally, the cardinal said, say something. Don't just sit there. Say something. Berate me if you must, but say something. And Jesus got up and walked over to him and kissed him on the cheek, on his wrinkled cheek. And the cardinal flung the door of the cell open and said, "Leave and never come back." It was tremendous. I can't reproduce it as Dostoevsky has put it together, but a tremendous indictment of any time we substitute or think of God as the controlling God instead of the loving God. And if we fail to understand that what he wants of us is the free, spontaneous love in response to his love, and that anything else we do out of fear or whatever is not what he wants. He doesn't want he doesn't want an army, and he doesn't want a zoo. He wants a family. And here he is. His son asks for his property, and his father gives it to him, and off he goes. The longer I pondered this quality of God, it's, you know, a human father won't go that far. You know, I suppose you'd say, no, of course he shouldn't. But I've seen fathers who have limited the freedom of their sons or daughters so much that they've never really been family. They've been controlled, and they haven't had the free concourse of this spontaneous love. I remember a tragic case where a boy, he was then 30, he hardly dared to buy an ice cream cone without asking his father for that money. His father had held him so tight that he had never, never really been allowed to use his freedom. Well, this remarkable thing about the father letting him go, I think that's a remarkable tribute to the father. A second observation, he went to the far country and squandered his living and got into trouble. And it wasn't strange, therefore, that he came to himself or came to his senses, remembering his father's house and saying, I'm going back home. Things had gotten to an awful pass for him. I wish there had been a second edition of this parable, and that the young man had gone to the far country and had invested this money in the best stocks and bonds, and had become the tycoon of the far country, the big shot, and that he'd made a rousing success in the far country. And then one night under a great, they threw a big party for him, and they're under glittering lights, everybody fawning over him and saying marvelous things about him, he suddenly came to his senses, came to himself, and said, "I don't belong here. I'm going back home to my father, and I'm going to say I don't deserve to be your son. But maybe I can be your hired servant." Because the point of the parable, I think, isn't how he managed in the far country, but the point of the parable is that he left home and went to the far country and lived by the standards of the far country. And whether he failed by those standards or succeeded by those standards, the point was that he had been away from his father. Now, I think that addition, if we'd had one, would probably address us better, us, the affluent, successful society, than this one. When I think of when people ask normally, "How's your boy getting along?" And I'd say as a father, "Oh, he's getting along just fine. He's got a good job. He's had 2 promotions. He's been invited to join the country club, and he's got a down payment on a lovely home, and he's married a very pretty wife, and they've got a couple little kids. He's just getting along wonderfully. Everybody seems to like him too." Now, any father saying that, he'd like to say that. That sounds good, and it isn't bad in it by itself upon an immediate examination. But supposing this son's job was in the mafia. Or, if not in the mafia, in a very corrupt police force. And he'd been successful and gotten a couple promotions. And everybody in the police force liked him. Now you see what that meant was that he had conformed to the standards of that corrupt police force. If he hadn't, they wouldn't have liked him, they wouldn't have promoted him, and he'd probably have lost his job. And so the father would have to say, well, things are kind of going to pot for him. He's not doing very well because he had a good job, but he lost the job, and nobody that he worked with seemed to like him. I can't understand that. Well, the point is that in the far country, if we talk about the shabby standards of much of the far country, say not all of the far country, but much of the far country, at least the standards short of the father's house, to succeed or not to succeed in that far country may not be the point. The point was that he went to the far country and left his father. And the style of life, let's say, that prevailed in the father's estates. Now the father had been waiting for him, and of course that's a remarkable thing. Who's it that has this book, The Waiting Father? Thielicke, yeah. Helmut Thielicke. The Waiting Father. And I read, you know, Roy Harrisville's little sermon. If I were God, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I wouldn't have done that. But here he was waiting for him and spied him. Well, the boy had rehearsed the speech. I'll go to my father and I'll say, I'm not worthy. I've sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm not worthy to be a son. Now let me be a hired servant. Well, he got halfway through the speech. That's all he got. In this account of Luke, he never got to propose an alternate status in his father's estate. His father said, Harry, turned to his servants and said, bring the best robe and the ring and get the fatted calf and get the party going. There wasn't a chance for him to come on with any other status than that of a son. There is no place for us in heaven or in the kingdom except as sons and daughters. I'll touch on that a little bit later, that it might be nicer if we didn't have to, but there's no chance. And then I thought, too, the remarkable thing when he talked about to his neighbors and said, my son who is dead is alive again, and my son who was lost is found, by which he's saying that when his son was in the far country, he was still his son. He didn't cease to be his son. Hell is filled with the sons and daughters of the father, who until the end didn't want to be with him. You know, I don't know how to come to terms with hell. Anyway, I have trouble there. I remember Dante, who said that if two people are estranged, if I'm estranged from you, let's say I cheated you, I stole money from you, and I don't want to see you because I have a bad conscience over against you. We are unreconciled. I remember two people in my congregation, one had offended the other or sinned against the other, and even though I tried to get them together and have them forgive and be restored, they were estranged. And I always noticed that if one of them came to church, the first one who came to church sat down on the right-hand side in front, the other one coming to church would always sit at the left-hand side in back. He didn't want anything to do with him. And I'm sure that if one of them had seen the other coming across the street, or walking on that side of the street, he would have walked on that side of the street. While Dante says that a person estranged from God, the very thing he doesn't want is to meet God. So he's always trying to run away from God. And then finally, the very worst thing happens. He dies, and he's plummeted into the presence of God. There he is. He's run away from him all his life. The worst thing that could happen to him was that he'd have to run into God. And suddenly, he's there. And Dante says there's only one worst thing that could happen to him, and that would be that he'd have to stay there. So God, in his great mercy, sends him to hell, where he doesn't have to see God. And now, however one interprets this everlasting separation from God, I'm not about to say. But the fact is that away in the far country, he's still a son, and has the love of the Father as much as when he was at home. I think, humanly speaking, I suppose, in a sense, that's way too. Not always. And I remember the story told about the lady who had 13 children, and she was asked, which of the 13 do you love the most? And she said, well, I suppose any time, at any given time, the child who needs me most. And so there is a sense in which you don't stop loving, and the Lord doesn't stop loving when somebody is away from him. I think also, I think of how did he come to himself? He came to himself because he had a memory of what it was like to be with God. And the church, I suppose, functions as the recaller, to recall to man by the message of God what God has done, and what he is like. And well, the parallel isn't quite right, because we don't think of a pre-existence where everybody lived with God and then came to the earth. And so you have a touch of memory from reincarnation. We don't deal in that stuff. But the church still has the task of reminding, of recalling, of enabling the human race to remember or to know what God is like. And it's the drawing power, really, of the gospel or the message that the Holy Spirit uses to bring a person to himself and to repentance and to a movement back. Now, just a touch about the banquet. I think of this young man sitting there by his father, and they were making merry, everybody having a great time. And then let's say that the son says to his father, Father, you'll never know how smelly that pigsty was. I still can feel it in my nose. And how great it is to be out of there. And then after a while, he says to the father again, Father, you'll never know how wonderful it is to be here. I keep thinking about that awful place out there. Well, if he talks that way for a while to his father, through this riotous fun and merriment, I would think the father would get thoroughly disgusted and say, now, son, stop thinking about that pigsty. It's all over with. You're back home. Get into the spirit of this, and have a good time. You're not supposed to fiddle around with that far country anymore. You're through with it, and you're back home. And this is difficult for us probably. I'm going to say that probably, in part, because we're always running back to the far country. See, even though we're back home with the Father, there is a sense in which, in this daily renewal, we've got to come back home again and again and again and again through repentance and faith and enjoying the home. And so the parallel isn't quite there, but we have a right to joy This is what that banquet tells me. We have a right to joy. And to have the past, the sordid past, leave us or drop off. And we've got to claim this joy in the face of our penchant, our inclination to go back over the past and mess around with that which has been forgiven and which we are to put away. Like Nancy mentioned here the other night about Dr. Osgood saying, "What? What is it? It isn't there, you know." Then to move swiftly on to the days following when he was back home. You know, there have been times that I've thought, maybe, just maybe, he wished that he could have finished the speech and come back on a 40-hour week. Then to move swiftly on to the days following when he was back home. You know, there have been times that I've thought, maybe, just maybe, he wished that he could have finished the speech and come back on a 40-hour week and lived down in the hot by the river and played his banjo with his friends. Instead of being up there in the big white house and having the family name and its honor to carry and the responsibilities of the estates 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, unrelenting, with never a vacation, you know, never a 40-hour week. Because this being back with the father and having the responsibilities of the kingdom is, in some respects, far greater pressure than if we could have the relationship of employer and employee. And really, that's what we'd like to have, as natural human beings. We'd like to have a job description, and we'd like to be able to come around and collect our paycheck. Not always be, having no paycheck, and probably having a little checkup once in a while, and you got a job description, you check off this and that, and see how you're doing, and having God give you your just dues. It's your rights, let's say, your rights. But you see, we've abdicated there. We are children, and we have no job description like that. We have the responsibilities of the whole kingdom, and the enterprises of God, and the only thing you've got is a kind of a pressure, this noblesse oblige, you belong to nobility, and nobility doesn't behave that way. And so you're left with the original freedom that you used to go away, the freedom that was restored back in the Father's house, and with all the pressures that freedom implies. Well, those are some of the observations that come to me now.
You've probably got other observations with this, because it's such a rich, rich parable.
Well, did the younger son have those responsibilities? I thought that he had given up all of his inheritance, and all that the father had left was to go to the other son.
Yeah, I suppose you can press that, but I think in the larger context of the parable, he's back as a son, and and he obviously has the name to carry, and the responsibilities of sonship. You're right that any parable like this, you press it too far and it's going to leak somewhere.
Why do you think that in the parable they added the part about the other son, how he got so upset and everything?
Yeah, well, it might be well to let's take a look at that too, as long as we're at it. The older son, in the meantime, was out in the field. On his way back, when he came close to the house, he heard the music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked, "What's going on?" "Your brother came back home," the servant answered, "and your father killed the prize calf because he got him back safe and sound." The older brother was so angry that he did not go into the house, so his father came out and begged him to come in. "Look," he answered back to his father, "all these years I've worked like a slave for you, and I never disobeyed your orders. What have you given me? Not even a goat for me to have a feast with my friends. But this son of yours wasted all your property on prostitutes, and when he comes back home, you kill the prize calf for him." "My son," the father answered, "you are always here with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to have a feast and be happy because your brother was dead, and now he's alive, and he was lost, but now he was found." Well, I suppose there are a lot of things. You can't say, well, that brother is kind of a scoundrel, because there's a lot of good things to say about that brother who stuck in there and did what was expected in the farm. The bad thing was, of course, that he resented grace, you might say. You know, you might say that he had lived by the letter. And I suppose you could even say that he wasn't aware, or refused to be aware, of the fact that everything he had was really as an heir of his father. It wasn't his by the fact that he had bought the farm. It was his also as a gift, and that while he conformed much better than the other son to the standards of the father's home, his great wrong was the fact that he'd forgotten that he too, while obedient, while conforming, he too was the son by sheer grace, just as his brother, now restored, was restored by sheer grace. At least that's one of the lessons I seem to draw from it.
Whose problem is it? Is it the son, the elder son's problem, or the father's? That his presence or their togetherness was not celebrated all along. Shouldn't we as Christians celebrate our grace as we go? And that's missing in that story.
Yeah. Yeah, you mean with the elder son?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he
should have had a fatted calf killed somewhere along the line.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. You mean the father let him down?
Or
the son?
He did not.
Or the son wasn't not didn't understand that he had freedoms, or had.
It's kind of the feeling that you get when dealing with some Christians who at a conversion or a born-again experience, as they call it, experience this joy that others of us who claim the Christian faith since birth should feel and experience also.
Mm-hmm.
But we go along
mm-hmm.
in our daily living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not right.
Yeah. And we don't go up to the plateau where we know joy. We're still children of the Father, but we don't claim the joy that we ought to.
Well, we don't have quite the ups and downs. We have the peace that God has given us, that is with us.
Yeah, and I think, too, the fact that the younger son or that elder son thought he had built up some rights.
Yeah.
And do we ever build up any rights with God? The moment we do, then we think we can collect them, which destroys grace and puts you back where you are an employer, or where God is the employer and you are the employee, and it's not by grace. I suppose the other parable of the people who worked in the vineyard, some came early, some came late, and they were all paid the same thing. And couldn't understand that we had built up some rights in the, and then the Lord of the vineyard says, well, I give you what I promised, and the fact that I give others more, it's mine to do with as I will. It's, a profounder understanding of that one, I think, is it a hard thing to be working in the vineyard of the Lord, or is it a privilege? Probably, if you turn it around and say that, supposing a person is married, and he's married 40 years, and another person is married, 2 years, and the person married 40 years thinks he's got far more right to happiness because he's endured it for 40 years, when the other one has endured it only for 2 years, which is a complete distortion of the fact that you've been married 40 years ought to make you under greater obligation of thanksgiving than at the end of 2 years. So working in the vineyard has to be thought of not as a thing you get money for, but as you get pleasure or accumulate happiness or joy.
Well, there was a good example of that this fall that just it came to my mind. It's when Mary Jo came to the high school, and she had applied all through last year and wrote 4 or 5. She had all kinds of telephone conversations this summer that she come. And then her friend Nina came, who had never heard about the program at all, but there was an opening for her, and she could come. And so in 2 weeks' time, something that Mary Jo had worked for a year and a half was given to Nina, but that's you think of opportunity and you don't think of love in that way. You can't diagram it into some sort of step kind of a thing.
Yeah.
If love can give, then it loves. Or if an opportunity can be given, it's given in that sense.
Yeah.
But that was really something we thought about this fall. That parable.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it sort of a pity that the elder brother or the brother didn't rejoice with the same abandon as the father? After all, this was his brother, and he should have been just as overjoyed. And wasn't he the poorer for not rejoicing?
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose for us, now he had been faithful. It was almost as if he resented his having been faithful. But those of us who have felt that we have been secure in the Christian life, to resent somebody
in the last moment sort of being saved. Well, that's inconceivable. You can't quite think of it. And consequently, to think of it, that the brother would resent the coming back of the brother.
But it's such a, for that little aside to have been added onto the story, is such a commentary on human nature.
And that's the way we're going to say that's human.
It's just, it's so real.
Yeah.
And it's such a, that is the way we are.
Yeah. I suppose you can have it happen in a congregation where somebody's been very faithful in the congregation. And then a new member comes in, who's probably been a scoundrel, and so he comes in, and after a year, he's elected chairman of the congregation, and everybody else gets mad because they.
That was interesting. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, it could even
happen here. I mean,
even happen. The same thing, you know. We get tremendous new staff people every year, and some of them immediately take a hold of something and really, you know, and sometimes some of us always sit around and think, well, who does he think he is? You know, he just got here. He's already doing all this stuff, and I've been here for the X number of years, and how come? Yeah. I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
and thankfully, I think most of the time you get around to the point where you can rejoice, but
yeah.
I think you feel resentment once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
This guy thinks he is. He knows everything.
Yeah, whatever else you say about that second son, he gives us a fairly good picture of how things operate.
I was going to mention Howard Berkman is down at the, he's working with John O'Neill now. His mother, 70 years old now, they had a big party for her in Port Arthur, and just hundreds of people came out to the party. Then one of the columnists, rather somebody who wrote the event up, wrote about Mrs. Berkman. And he made it real clear, it was really beautiful how he described, you know, her living. He said, at 70 years, she was always able to celebrate, and I mean in the Christian sense of celebrate, through the good and the bad times. And again, to have, she had three or four boys, and she lost her husband in the early 60s, and she ran this flower business all these years in Port Arthur. And he made this distinction about so many senior citizens or old people, there seem to be either always griping about life and how, I have another day, kind of like the cartoon Karin had at Matins today. And really what he described, if you were there at Matins, how he described Howard's mother was simply, another day. Whatever that ending was. And that's how she lived. And Howard now, who's 30 years old and, you know, thinking of things, just, it was really, it was a blessing to see that, how people reacted to the way his mom had lived all these years. It was a beautiful statement about, the excitement. Like she just mentioned, the ups and downs aren't as big, but faith.
Yeah. I think, as I said, we do in this daily renewal, where we're always going over the border into that far country and living by the far country standards, and have to come back, and at the same time we have the security of being right in at home all the time, as we are His. But we're flirting all the time with the ways of the far country, and therefore have a constant need for being brought back and being glad to be back and getting up to the table and having a feast again. So it's it isn't as if all of us are solidly back home, which I assume we are by grace. But it isn't as if we're never again tantalized by the far country. We're always fooling around the borders. Never quite making as merry as we ought to. Well, the sun is shining, and I think you ought to go outside. I thought it was very bad to come in when the sun was so nice.